You are listening to the cycling podcast of the 2023 Tour de France. Today, we're in Morzines, les Portes du Soleil.
No! Unbelievable! 500 meters to go to the top of the Jupelin. Pogačar and Vingegaard were riding so slowly, looking at each other. Pogačar took his moment, he went for the attack, and he had to stall because he got held up by a race motorbike. Now 400 metres to go, Pogačar's on the front, and he's completely stuck. There's nothing he can do, the crowd is closing in on him. The crowd here at the finish line was just about to erupt with roars of excitement, and now they're just looking at each other again. What a crazy finish at the top of this climb.
That was Lizzie Banks at the finish line reacting to the moment of the stage, the big incident at the top of the Col du Jupelin when Tadej Pogačar launched his sprint with about 500 metres to go to get those bonus seconds at the top of the climb, and the two motorbikes were just far too close and forced him to stall his effort and really got in the way of the decisive moment of today's stage 14 of the Tour de France. And that means Lizzie Banks, EF Education TIBCO SVB rider, fresh from the Giro d'Honor, is here on the Tour de France. Welcome, Lizzie.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Lionel, even if you can only just hear me over the sound of forklift trucks in the background, because I think we're parked next to where the start village is going to be set up tomorrow morning in Leger.
Indeed we are, yeah. We're in our hotel on the balcony having a post-race drink, and the Tour de France is literally setting up around us, and we will do our best, hopefully. Hopefully they won't start the stage while we're sat here recording tonight's episode. But Ian Boswell also here. What a stage today. We're going to break down all of the drama and excitement, but welcome, Ian.
It's good to be here again, Lionel.
Penultimate night on the Tour de France for this year.
This is the Tour de France. We're in the thick of it today.
We are in the thick of it. We better break down the details of what happened on today's stage.
It's time for the tale of the attack.
Well, we've moved inside here at our hotel because the beeping of all the forklift trucks reversing and the clanking of barriers would probably be an unpleasant listening experience. Certainly very distracting out there. And it was a difficult enough stage to keep track of, wasn't it? Stage 14. It went from Annemasse to Morzine. It was, again, only pretty short, 151.8 kilometres, five categorised climbs, including three first category climbs and then the all category climb of the Col du Jupelin. And all of you out there who rode the Étape du Tour, you will be very familiar with the parcours from today. Off to a bit of a disrupted start because there was a very, very bad crash after no more than 6 kilometres. There was a little bit of rain at the start, and Ian, we were hailing the skies, weren't we? Because it's been blisteringly hot the last few days, and it was such a relief to have some cold moisture falling from the air, but not so great for the riders because it's been so dry for so long. And it wasn't a proper downpour, it was just a sprinkling. And so it meant that the descents, well, the roads in general, were slippery. And the crash on that little bit of downhill was severe. Lots of riders hit the deck, and the race doctors and the ambulance had to be called upon. And several withdrawals from that crash, not least Louis Menkes of Intermarché, who was lying 13th overall. I don't want to make the obvious unlucky for some there, because unfortunately Louis Menkes fractured his collarbone and is out of the race. There were lots of fallers, and eventually after about a 20-25 minute delay, the race did get going. And before we knew it, there was another crash, wasn't there, on the descent of the Col de Feu. And Romain Bardet, 12th overall, is also out of the race, as is EF Education's James Shaw. Really disappointing for Shaw, because he was talking up his hopes of getting in breaks today, tomorrow, and again in the final weeks. Been riding really well in this Tour de France. A big shame for him. Overall, we lost a few riders today. I'll run through them at the end. The GC race really kicked off in the approach to the Col du Jupelin, and Tom Pidcock was the first rider to be in any difficulty today. He got dropped, and then we'll discuss Jumbo-Visma's tactics, UAE, Team Emirates' response, but it was on the Jupelin that the race really exploded into life, and the group whittled down, mainly under the pressure from Sepp Kuss. But there was that wonderful little moment where Tadej Pogačar gave Adam Yates, his teammate, a little nod to go to the front and just drive the pace and split the group down even further. And then Pogacar launched his attack 3.7 kilometers from the top of the Jouplan, opened a gap, very similar to every other time we've seen Vingegaard get distanced. He kind of loses contact and then holds the gap, and then the gap opens a little bit more, and it took him a couple of kilometers to close back up. And then we saw this incredible kind of track sprint tactics where the pace really dropped off. And then there was the incident with the motorbike. We'll talk about that in the next part. And before we knew it, Carlos Rodriguez of Ineos Grenadiers was in the front of the race, and he descended down into Morzine to give Ineos their second stage win in a row. And finally, we had the sprint for the line where Pogacar pipped Jonas Vingegaard at the finish to make up for losing the sprint on the top of the Jouplan. And what it means is that this morning, Vingegaard led by 9 seconds, and this evening he leads by 10 seconds. Extraordinary stuff, really. The Tour de France is not being decided at the moment. It's going to go certainly into next week by the looks of it. On the GC then, Carlos Rodriguez, a stage winner, has moved up to third place. Jai Hindley has dropped down to fourth. He fell in that early crash. Sepp Kuss, as a result of all that teamwork, has moved up from 10th to 6th, bumping everybody else down a bit, little bit. And Felix Gall of AG2R is into the top 10 as well, climbing 5 places. The King of the Mountains competition, well, Jonas Vingegaard has taken the lead from Nielsen Paulus, but Paulus will, of course, still wear the jersey tomorrow. They're currently tied on points, but Pogacar is only 6 points behind, so Paulus's hopes of winning that jersey are receding. And I said I'd run through the riders who've pulled out. Menkes and Bardet, I mentioned already, and Shaw as well. But we also lost Movistar's Ruben Guerrero, EF Education's Esteban Chavez, Movistar's Antonio Pedrero, and Alpecin De Koenig's Ramon Cinquedam. Quite a breathtaking stage today, and we will discuss all of the big incidents next.
The cycling podcast at the 2023 Tour de France is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to our long-term sponsors, Science in Sport, who are world leaders in endurance nutrition. The SIS Beta Fuel, which was first developed for the Ineos Grenadiers, or Team Sky as they were then actually, it's now available to all, and each dual source energy gel contains 40 grams of carbohydrate from maltodextrin and fructose, scientifically proven to increase energy efficiency and deliver an enhanced power output during max efforts. And well, we saw this back in the 2018 Giro d'Italia when Chris Froome took off on the stage to Bardonecchia and put loads of time into Simon Yates, who was holding the pink jersey. He won the stage by 3 minutes. And a key part of that day was the fueling strategy. Team Sky put helpers all along the course to make sure that Froome would be able to take on board Beta Fuel at regular intervals and stay fueled and hydrated. So fuel, hydrate and recover like the Ineos Grenadiers riders at scienceinsport.com.
This is Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, sitting at the back of the bag.
Stage 13 of the Tour de France, and I have to admit that today's was not an easy one. First of all, because of that massive crash at kilometre 6. I always admire the way the organisation of the Tour de France reacts in case of a big crash. Thierry Gouvenou immediately took the radio and asked that the race was neutralised. He knows exactly, as a former rider, when it's very serious, and it was very serious. We had, around 20, 25, 30 riders on the ground. And in those situations, the idea is, to neutralise the race so that the doctors can attend to all the injured riders, and there were quite a few of them. So we stopped the race, we waited for several riders to be evacuated in ambulances, then we waited for new ambulances to come, because you can't continue the tour or the stage if you don't have the ambulances, just in case. And because it's the Tour de France, because they have that power, it always goes very quickly. So that was a first part that was rather tricky to handle. And then was the crowds. In 19 years on the Tour de France, I honestly think I've never seen so many people on the side of the roads. I don't know if it's the Netflix effect, but the climbs are absolutely crazy, and it is, to be honest, a bit worrying because you feel that sometimes the riders just can't attack. There's so many people in the middle of the road I sincerely hope that it won't have an effect on the race in the days to come.
That was Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour. I mean, he had his hands full today trying to keep track of everybody that had crashed and everything that was going on. And I think for listeners out there and also for ourselves, sometimes it's easy to forget just what a fantastic position Seb Piquet has in the race. I mean, he sees everything unfold. He's there in the car with Thierry Gouvenou, who's the man who effectively designs the route of the Tour de France. And he's a real big deal in the Tour de France, Seb Piquet, but he still couldn't get the number of the stage right. He said it was stage 13 there, but correction, corner Seb, it was stage 14 today. And, let's just quickly talk about that first crash, because it did kind of shape the rest of the day, didn't it? There was the delay. We knew the stage would finish late. Lots of riders hit the deck. They would have been sort of nursing through with, the effects of that crash. You know, Jai Hindley lost time. He was somebody who went down. But the correct decision was made, clearly, to pause the race, make sure everybody was okay, and then resume when everyone was ready.
Absolutely. I mean, crashes are never good. And, you know, to see riders come to the finish line already almost properly bandaged is kind of a nice thing to see in cycling. You know, the riders are actually able to fully be checked out before getting on their bike. And as we heard, you know, the main issue is the ambulances. And, you know, there's so many ambulances behind the race. If one or two riders go off to hospital, then there's no ambulances following the race. And, you know, hats off to ASO, to the UCI for making sure and kind of holding to that policy to make sure that if something does happen, that, you know, a medical team and medical staff are there ready to respond.
And the impressive thing today was they made that decision so quickly. I mean, and it's not just that they needed to make the decision. You couldn't get any cars through. There were riders all the way across the road. No vehicles at all were able to pass. So then it was only going to be a commissaire's car in the front of the race. And in that situation, the race has to be neutralized. There was no race situation that had already happened. The brake hadn't formed, but it definitely impacted the way the race was afterwards, because some riders were shaken by it, understandably, not really wanting to go, not really sure whether they should start racing yet.
And not trusting the road surface either.
Exactly.
You know, the roads didn't dry up for probably, another hour or so. They still had to go up the climb and then down the descent. So it shaped that early phase of the race for sure. But what about the big incident of the day? Let's get right into it, because the whole of this Tour de France has been set up to be close. The race route has been designed by Thierry Gouvenou and his team to be close. They've thought really carefully about how to make sure that it wasn't all done and dusted through the Pyrenees, and that Le Puy de Dôme wouldn't be the final kind of decisive moment after the end of week one. They have the time bonuses on these climbs to encourage racing and to make these moments. And then we get exactly what everybody's hoping for. The best two riders in the race, 1 and 2 on GC, split by 9 seconds this morning. They're coming up the climb together. I mean, when Pogacar made that move and then Vingegaard closed up, I mean, next season's Netflix series was being made in front of our eyes, wasn't it? And then when Pogacar launched from a long way out, admittedly, the motorbikes just weren't ready. It was difficult to see what was ahead of that and whether they couldn't move, but they certainly didn't move quick enough, and they really affected the race.
That is a common problem, though. I mean, and Ian, you will know, of course, from being in the peloton often, and we saw it a couple of days ago, Wout van Aert telling the motorbike to just get out of the way. You know, often there is a race incident happening now and they just don't react. And it definitely needs to be something that has to be looked into and has to be changed, because we can't have it affecting the outcome, especially in a race like the Tour de France when it's so close.
Yeah, I mean, and this was, as you said, Lionel, this race was designed, and these bonuses have been added because it adds an element of excitement to the race. And the fact that they know that there's a sprint at the top of this climb and they didn't put barriers there. You know, once the incident happened, I was looking closely to see what was there anything there, and all we saw was a rope, which everyone knows a rope is very flexible and the fans can, you know, push that rope in. And as much as I am disappointed, and like, it really is in a way disgraceful that this happened at the Tour de France, the biggest bike race in the world, I'm also reminded that this is cycling and this stuff happens all the time and it's just part of it. And, you know, we could get to Paris and this could be the incident that shapes the race, or it could be completely irrelevant and everyone forgets.
True. I mean, at the moment, it feels really significant because Vingegaard and Pogacar are separated by so few seconds. I mean, my old brain just sinks back to the 1988 Tour de France on Alpe d'Huez, where the crowds were huge and there was a group of four of the leading riders on GC and they wanted to make attacks and the motorbikes were just blocking the way completely. And I think, well, I've spoken to Graham Watson, the photographer, who was on the climb that day, and he said that they changed the rules about how many bikes could be in front of the lead group. But here we are, what, 35 years later, and we're still having motorbikes influencing the race and preventing one of the best riders in the world from executing the tactic that he wanted to execute when he wanted to execute it. Yes, I know the crowds are big, but it's a disappointing one because we could have been looking at a different GC tonight. Okay, it might only have been seconds, but it changed everything for Pogacar that. As we saw, when Vingegaard then went, took the seconds at the top, Pogacar tried to then attack on as they went just over the false flat and then onto the descent. It clearly unsettled him and changed what he was doing.
I mean, and this race hasn't been a tour of changing hands of the yellow jersey, but it has been a change of momentum. And, you know, as far as I can recall, this is the first time that Jonas has beat Pogacar in a time bonus, or, you know, a sprint finish. And so does this, in a way, change the tides, change the momentum in Vingegaard's hand, where, hey, you know, I mean, you know, Pogacar did not have a clean run at it, but does it give Vingegaard a little bit of, you know, thought that, hey, you know what, I can actually go mano a mano and match him in a sprint?
Yeah, I don't think it will affect Pogacar's sort of mental outlook towards it. But what I do think is that in that initial moment, straight after the incident, he sort of seemed to be quite shaken. He almost didn't really seem to be thinking straight from a viewing perspective. He was riding on the front. He'd slowed down so much. He'd almost lost the focus that the fact that what he was aiming for just 10 seconds ago was this bonus sprint, because all he could think about was everything that had just happened. But you said to me earlier, Ian, that you think that actually it may have been an issue with just the lactate in his legs as well.
Yeah, and I'd heard at the finish line from some Slovenians that he didn't sprint at the finish. I mean, part of it is probably psychological, that he was a bit mentally taken out of it, but that he had made this effort and he'd kind of almost come to an abrupt stop and, you know, kind of just, you know, was overcome with lactic acid and wasn't prepared to then make another sprint.
Or couldn't
do it again, mm-hmm. Yes. Although, that being said, he did attack after the summit of the climb. But you never know how riders feel.
He's a racer, though. That's the thing. And I suppose that's what's most frustrating. You know, it's very rare that we get a rider that is so aggressive and unpredictable. I mean, I wouldn't have said that he would go over 500 metres from the top of the Jouplan to try and get those seconds. Thought maybe to leave it a bit closer, but we want to see the riders have a blank canvas to create the race. I know he wasn't the only rider impacted by the motorbikes, I gather, although I didn't see it. Carlos Rodriguez also was blocked by motorbikes, and from going around the team buses, I think Mick Rogers, who is part of the UCI and an ex-rider, of course, but he is likely to get quite a few complaints this evening about the conduct of the motorbike drivers. I don't want to point the finger at them and say it's their fault, but clearly they were in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they may well pay a price for that. At the finish, Pogacar, though, did beat Vingegaard and got those seconds, and so after all of that, the difference was 1 second. And, I mean, that is what we're kind of all craving in the Tour de France, isn't it? It is a race of seconds at the moment, and it really sets up for a fantastic day tomorrow. But, Ian, last night we were talking about how well UAE Team Emirates were doing. They looked totally like they had the upper hand with 5 riders to 2. Today was a different story, wasn't it? Jumbo-Visma really struck back. And, I mean, you made a mention of it. Maybe that was the plan. Yesterday, take it easy so that they could hit today a lot harder. And they certainly did.
Absolutely. And you know, when you look at today's stage, multiple climbs versus yesterday, which was essentially just a finishing climb, you know, were their teammates more valuable? And we heard this in the press conference after the race. You know, how can Jumbo isolate Pogacar? And, you know, yesterday with one climb, you know, with the team they have here, they don't really have riders to kind of set the pace for a whole climb. You know, Van Barle's an amazing climber, but he's more versatile over a stage that has multiple climbs. And so today their tactic was, can we, you know, just slowly drain Pogacar over the whole stage, and then maybe on the final climb he's more drained than he was yesterday when it was just one climb up to the finish.
Well, you spoke to a few people from Jumbo-Visma, Ian. Sepp Kuss, who was, well, almost man of the match today, really, wasn't he? He rode so strongly, and he's moved up the GC as well. But also Frans Madsen, one of their sports directors, who talks about the incident with the motorbikes, and also the issue of this race for bonus seconds and the fact that, well, Pogacar and Vingegaard are going to have to go for them.
Sepp, after yesterday, you guys definitely came into today's stage with a plan. Did it go to plan in the end?
For sure. I mean, we rode the race like we wanted to. A lot of teams were asking, what are you doing? Riding with the breakaway there 20 seconds in front the whole time. But we just, wanted to ride our rhythm and make it a tough day and then try on the last climb. But, no regrets. We gave it everything. And Jonas was still really strong. But, Pogacar is right there with him. And it's still a huge battle.
Were you surprised about anything today? As we saw, Jumbo-Visma were right in the front. Tell us a little bit more about it, and also about Tadej Pogacar.
Yeah, I was surprised how much the guys that weigh 20 kilos more than me were making me suffer on the climbs. But that's a nice feeling when everybody's motivated for a plan. And Jonas was also motivating us the whole time, saying that he felt really good and that we were riding well, even though it was a hard day. And the team and Jonas especially gave it everything.
What was the ideal plan before the last descent? It was ideal to have solo Vingegaard already there.
Yeah, ideally. It's good that he came back to Pogacar and could get the bonus seconds on the top. In the finish, you never know who goes ahead and can take the stage win. So that also takes some of the bonus seconds. But ideally you want a beautiful solo victory.
Yeah, the motorbikes was of course some pity because they couldn't attack then anymore. And there was such a huge crowd, you couldn't. It's a battle between safety and all the people who want to cheer, and it was quite dangerous, yes. Yeah, of course you keep it in mind, but it's not the most important thing. We wanted to try to hit Pogacar, but he did also hit us, and I think at the end it was a 1-1.
Are you thinking more in minutes than seconds then?
Now it is about seconds, but also possible one day it can go with minutes. You saw today some really great riders like Pidcock or Bilbao or Yates, they lost minutes. This can happen also to one of those two.
There was a curious moment with Jumbo-Visma though, wasn't there? Because Wout van Aert was riding very strongly, but then Micah came to the front to make sure he would get dropped, but then Wout van Aert fought his way back up, went back up to the front, forcing Micah to come back up to the front to drop him again. And it looked a little bit like maybe Wout van Aert overplayed his hand there when he got back on, and perhaps might have been a bit better advised to just sit tight for a little bit, hang in and be a bit more used further up the climb. Easy for me to say from the comfort of the press room. I don't know what you thought.
Well, I was going to say I was pretty impressed with Wout van Aert's ride throughout the day, because Col de la Rama is very hard. You rode it the weekend, Ian. I rode it a few weeks ago. He was right at the front when Pidcock was getting dropped on that climb. And I wondered if that was a direct response to your insinuation that he was planning to have his baby at the wrong time of the year, Lionel.
Retracted.
I mean, I think there's been a lot of discussion around, the Netflix series and kind of this narrative that they built that, maybe Wout is not the best teammate, or maybe he has some of his own, kind of motives hidden behind, his team role that he's playing here. Because as you know well, Lizzie, he had ridden a hard effort, he was popped, not always, but you sometimes have a little bit more to give. And to come back up to the front and make that effort was really pointless. In my opinion, that he came up, he upped the pace. Rafa and the climbers were all setting this very sustained pace.
What was
he gonna do? They know the climb, and so what he did was he popped Micah, and then it was Sepp left to ride, and we don't know how far Rafael Micah would have taken that group of climbers up the climb, and the effort that he made to go from off the back all the way to the front and then up the pace. You know, he didn't sit on for a bit. Okay, how's the pace? Can I move up? Can I be assistance? Mm. In my opinion, it reminded me very much of a TV attack. And you know, I was watching on the screen, you know, there's exclamation points, you know, Van Aert has rejoined the group. And he,
you think he's got a direct earpiece to the Netflix producers? is that what you're telling us?
No, but I just I really didn't. If he had that level of, you know, freshness still left, that could have been used to pull longer at the bottom of the climb. So, you know, clearly when he pulled off, you know, I mean, Micah took over the climb when they got to the bottom, but it was a big effort that he made and it didn't really benefit Vingegaard at all.
No, I would agree.
So, I mean, what have we learned today? I mean, 1 second was the difference. We still have a race of only 10 seconds. It strikes me that UAE Team Emirates and Jumbo-Visma are actually very evenly matched. They're just not evenly matched at the same time. They're choosing different times to put their sort of footprint on the race. It's starting to look like Tuesday's time trial is going to be really important, because that's the only opportunity where Vingegaard and Pogacar will just race the road. And it will just be down to whoever stops the clock first. Because in the actual racing, they're just watching each other. They're not really able to crack one another. And they're just going to tease out seconds here and there.
Yeah, I mean, it's been an awesome week to be on the tour, because this is so exciting. Every day, you know, they're going blow for blow. And, you know, I saw Pogacar at the base of the Jouplan, you know, take his gloves and throw them off. And I was like, the suspense is building. And, you know, the fact that we had such a hard stage and 1 second changed, you know, there's been no different, you know, they've been so, you know, mano a mano every single day. And then, you know, Pogacar slowly crawled himself back. And yet Vingegaard today, in fairness, was the first time that he matched Pogacar's acceleration. You know, Pogacar made this attack pretty far out from the top of the Jouplan, but he was able to claw himself back before the summit. And, you know, if anything, maybe, in my opinion, kind of proved today that, you know, maybe he can actually win this tour.
It's interesting looking ahead to the time trial, because it is a tricky time trial and they are quite different riders. So, you know, I think it will be close, because they're both very, very good riders and they clearly have similar watts per kilo. But I think they will ride it in very different ways, and that might mean that we see quite different time splits. I think we will, I don't think we'll see a big difference there, but maybe 10 or 20 seconds, maybe 10 seconds. I don't know.
I mean, one of the things that Jonas said in the press conference again was that he doesn't think this race will be won on seconds and time bonuses. This race will be won by minutes, which means, you know, there's kind of 4 stages left where something will happen.
So he's expecting to absolutely blow up one day. Is that right? The thing is, we've seen tours before where the GC riders all kind of finish together. You know, the pace has been hard, but there's not been any real racing. This tour is totally different. There is racing between those two, and the others are kind of trying to keep on the coattails. And, well, Carlos Rodriguez did more than that today. We'll talk about Ineos Grenadiers in the next part, but I just want to reference again that moment of the day for me was the little nod from Pogacar to Adam Yates. It was almost a goosebump moment, because their teammates, Adam Yates is a great rider in his own right. He's had the yellow jersey and won a stage, of course, right back in Bilbao. Feels like a lifetime ago now. But it was just a moment that just indicated that they're on the same wavelength. They're totally committed to a plan. I mean, you wouldn't expect them not to be. But to see it actually in 3D, I thought was a great moment.
Yeah, I mean, it was old school cycling, you know, and the race was being decided on the road. You know, there wasn't something coming across the radio, okay, now's the time to attack. You know, Pogacar felt the moment. He knew, you know, based off what was happening with, you know, the speed that Sepp was riding, and looked over to Adam and said, all right, this is our plan, now's the moment. And clearly something they had discussed before the race, that, hey, if we feel good, we're going to hit it on this climb.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
We are very proud to be supported by MAP, who have also created our fantastic cycling podcast jersey and lots of other fantastic jerseys. They've really pushed the envelope when it comes to cycling jersey design. And one of the key aspects of their product development is testing products as they create them. And this is Harry Osborne, the head of design, on how they identify the right types of riders to test MAP clothing.
Product testing is clearly an essential part of the design and development process. As we're going through that process, we're constantly looking to build concepts, test them, and then resolve them. Essentially, it starts with people within the business. You know, we're all riders. We have a level of experience that will allow us to test. If we're liking it and we're thinking it's got a great feeling on the bike, it's then a good opportunity to look within our community and see who we can bring in that's going to provide, you know, some wider feedback, a different opinion, or some more detailed insights into, you know, a particular problem we might want to be solving for. We have a great roster of, you know, amateur cyclists and people within our community who are, you know, really engaged in helping us test product. But then on the flip side, you know, we have an ever-growing professional sort of athlete roster, people like Freddie Ovette, who can provide a level of detail that is unique to the amount of riding and the amount of experience they have. A good example is Chris Burkhardt, who is currently doing the Tour Divide in the US. And, you know, we've been working closely with him on analysing and getting feedback on our alt-road bib shorts, which he is wearing. And, you know, he had some feedback on bits he thinks we can improve. And we've, you know, built a prototype for him that he's currently wearing on that huge epic adventure. So, you know, that feedback cycle is ever evolving, and we're constantly trying to look where we can get that feedback from and how we can incorporate it into the design process.
Go to map.cc to check out the entire range of MAP's clothing for on and off the bike. Well, we've not yet been trapped inside the Tour de France village. We're still free as a bird, but the tour is being set up around us outside. We should talk about the stage winner, Carlos Rodriguez, a young man still. He's only 22 and clearly a huge talent. And today he gave Ineos two stage wins in 2 days. And I wonder how much credit Dave Brailsford would be taking, because apparently he arrived on the race yesterday. He was certainly there this afternoon.
He was looking pretty happy.
He was looking pretty happy there in his kind of Tom Cruise from Top Gun sunglasses and his white shirt and trousers, looking very dapper. Ducked out of the way before I could have a quick chat with him. But Ineos Grenadiers, you know, we were talking at the start of the tour about what are they doing? What are they here for? What are they looking for in this transitional phase? And all of a sudden, they've got a rider on the podium and two stage wins in the same number of days. Incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it really has been kind of a turn of events for that team. You know, we spoke to Rod yesterday at the finish line, and he mentioned that as well, that it is a transitional moment for the team. But, you know, within the blink of an eye, a rider on the podium, two stage wins in 2 days. And I heard yesterday at the bus of Ineos, you know, Rod was saying that their goal was two stage wins. And of course, they just won with Kwiatkowski. And I was thinking, okay, well, when are they going to get their second stage win? That didn't take long.
Because we thought that Rodriguez and Pidcock would be too close to the GC, too much in the GC battle to be given any leeway. I mean, we should just say, caveat this with the fact that had Pogacar and Vingegaard not slowed down and done their kind of track sprint tactics at the top of the Juplan, Rodriguez might not have got back. I think it was like 51 seconds or something behind at that point. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, it's an absolute seal of approval for the statement that you just keep riding in a stage race. You just keep going and you never know where it might take you.
And that funny business between Pogacar and Vingegaard didn't have any effect on the gap between Rodriguez and Jai Hindley behind, because now Rodriguez is only 1 second ahead of Jai Hindley. And when Jai Hindley crossed the finish line in front of me after the race, he was really, I mean, I don't know how he was physically, but his clothes were torn to pieces, arms, back, and his side. And that's going to start to affect him in the next 1 or 2 days. If that starts to affect him on the rest day, then how's he going to feel going into the time trial? And that's a massive, massive factor. And now Ineos obviously have the psychological boost of having two stage wins. Of course, they've had a little bit of trouble with Pidcock today, but I heard him after the stage, and you know, he was actually relatively chipper considering what happened.
Well, let's hear from Tom Pidcock after the stage. The first of the GC riders to be dropped, really, or certainly the first of the top 10 to be dropped. He really battled very hard to stay on, but just couldn't do it. We thought he might make up time on the descent, but he couldn't do that either. And then, well, it was going to be hard with that bit of valley road before the start of the Juplan. Steve Cummings and Rod Ellingworth have both been talking about the importance for Pidcock of kind of hitting his head on the ceiling and finding out where his limits lie. I'm not saying that today he found out where his limits lie, but he certainly found out where they lie for the moment.
Well, Tom, we know about the crash early in the day, and we know we've seen the result, but tell us the story of your day in your own words.
It was a very hard day. Yeah, it's a shame really. I was full of confidence this morning. You know, imagining doing this epic attack off the top of the Zouplam. Obviously, I wasn't really making a big deal out of it. But yeah, then just we started full gas and I just didn't really have it in me. And yeah, I thought maybe I could save a little bit over the Ramas, but yeah, I didn't come back under the centre. And yeah, then I was just cooked. And then I took my radio out and then I come down the coming back to the bus, everyone's saying congratulations. And then yeah, Carlos won, so it makes it a bit better.
Tom, that moment on the top of the Ramaz, you were only about 30 seconds off the lead group and we thought that you might well get back. I think Van Aert was pulling at the front. Just from your point of view, talk to us about that descent and the valley as well.
Well, I didn't have any motorbikes in front of me, did I? So it had a fun. It's not really a very technical descent, to be honest, so yeah, it's hard to make up time there.
And it was a slightly different race today with Jumbo-Visma sort of pulling all day, and it was more of an old school kind of Tour de France stage. Any questions of that not suiting you as much as the stages as they've been ridden until now?
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think, need to evaluate it a little bit, but I just didn't have enough energy, basically, I think, you know, yesterday, late stage, late dinner, not really eating off us, not really...
We've talked a bit in the past few days, Ian, about Carlos Rodriguez and this rumour that he's on his way to probably Movistar. Well, this evening, Steve Cummings certainly said that he hopes he doesn't leave. He didn't, you know, give the impression that the deal was done. I mean, he would be a big asset to Ineos Grenadiers, somebody that they could build a Grand Tour team around.
Well, we've been speaking about this, you know, who are the riders that can win a Grand Tour? And in the last number of years, it's really been three riders. You know, you've had, well, I guess four if you had, you know, Roglic in there as well and Remco. But he is young enough that he could develop into a rider. And in my opinion, Ineos does need to do everything they can to try to keep him around, because he's shown in this tour, you know, we're nearly 2 weeks in, that he is a rider who's capable of, you know, riding with the best GC riders in the world.
Ian, this morning you spoke to yesterday's man of the day, Michał Kwiatkowski, about his stage win. So let's hear from the Polish former world champion and twice Tour de France stage winner.
Big win yesterday. How are you feeling today?
So far, so good. But I slept 4 hours. So there was a lot of emotions. I woke up like 4 a.m., kind of fresh. But on the same time, if you sleep only 4 hours at the Tour de France, it means you need to catch up.
I mean... And what does that victory mean to you? You've been world champ, you've won a stage here at the Tour before, but still, I mean, clearly it was an emotional victory. Why is that?
I'm the guy who always looking ahead, so, you know, even having a good palmarès, it doesn't mean, that I'm not motivated for the future. You know, they were telling me that I'm over 30 now and stuff like this, but, you know, I like to work hard. Victories obviously helps with that, but on the end of the day, I just want to perform well in the future races. That's my goal, and hopefully I can take some more wins. Yeah.
Has it become challenging to balance working for the team and trying to seek personal results?
Yeah, obviously it is, but it's always nice to open a bottle of champagne after your win, but on the same time it's great to celebrate with the victory of your teammates. So this is professional cycling. It's not Formula One that you have big ego and you always kind of drive for your own result. Here you have to really collaborate and think about, you know, the team effort, and because sooner or later you will need your boys up there in the road, and that's why I'm happy to help whenever I can.
Congratulations, man.
Thank you.
It was interesting to see Dave Brailsford here, because he has really stepped away from the cycling team. He's been working with Jim Ratcliffe on this bid to buy Manchester United Football Club. He's been working with Nice, the football club in the French Ligue 1. And, well, he was there today, you know, high-fiving Rod Ellingworth, no doubt taking all the credit for the two stage wins. But I think there was a bit of intel from this morning, Ian, that Brailsford said, well, you won yesterday, we're going to win again today.
Yeah, I was speaking to one of the Soigneurs actually at the finish, and he had mentioned that Dave was on the race, and, you know, maybe implying that I should go say hi, but I'm busy man today. But yeah, he had mentioned that on the bus this morning that Dave said, hey, we're going to win again today, which I assume at the start the team maybe wouldn't have thought, but sure enough, yeah, they won once again.
And just a note about Ben Turner, who didn't finish yesterday. He has had some kind of sickness bug and obviously not going to carry on in a tour with sickness. Let's hope that hasn't sort of spread its way around the team. I mean, it can do, can't it, living in close quarters with one another. But quite a couple of days for Ineos. We'll wrap up all the other things that happened today in the next part. Well, now we have a race of seconds for first and second, and a race of seconds, or 1 second, for third and fourth, and another big stage in the mountains tomorrow.
L'étape de demain, le dîner d'hier. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
First of all, though, Ian, last night's dinner. We thought we'd won the Tour de France by staying just a few kilometres away, and our hotel in Anglefort was absolutely rammed when we got there. We started to worry about whether the kitchen would be able to cope with dinner, but they coped admirably. It was a really nice dinner, actually, wasn't it?
They did, once things calmed down. At first, we tried to get a big beer. We got a small beer. And then the second time we went for beers, our pints came in plastic cups. So a little bit disappointed. But
just plastic cups, but sort of those squashy plastic cups like you'd have on a picnic.
Or in the US, we'd say like a red solo cup for beer pong. but things did turn around from there. Once the table was set and the Tour de France had moved out of town, we had a lovely meal. I had some steak. I think I've eaten more steak in the last 7 days than I've eaten in the last year of my life. And you had some alpine salmon.
Yeah, well, we were miles and miles from the sea, so I thought I'd have some salmon. Very
well,
nice
it was,
though.
You're in cheese country tonight, so you can have cheese on a bed of cheese with cheese on top.
Brilliant, brilliant. I like to eat so much cheese that I start to see sort of stars in front of my eyes. That's what I like
to
do in the Alps.
I did offer to bring you a kilo of cheese from the cheese vending machine on my ride today, but you said that it would get a little too sweaty in the van.
Well, the thing is, we've rented the van from our good friend Simon the photographer, and I don't want to take it back smelling of cheese. That's the only reason. What's on the menu for the riders tomorrow, Lizzie?
It's another really tough day in the mountains again tomorrow. Over 4,000 metres of climbing from Léger to Saint-Gervais via the very scenic route. Three category one climbs, a third category climb, and a second category climb. And the second category climb is what I think may be the key climb of the day. It's sort of I described it in the kilometre zero as the Amuse-Bouche to the Saint-Gervais climb. It's a couple of kilometres at 10%. It's very hot, right in the, you know, right in the face of the sun. So steep, so hard, and straight afterwards you have this 9 kilometer climb up to Saint-Gervais. So I think sparks could fly there, and if somebody wants to go early, that would be the place to do it.
Well, we will be back tomorrow night to discuss stage 15, or as Seb Piquet will call it, stage 14, and then it's the rest day. And well, it's the weekend now and the rest day on Monday, so probably a good time to catch up on all of our Kilometre Zero episodes, which have been going out over the course of the week. Hopefully everyone's enjoying Francois Tomaso's tour tales. Lizzie's road trip was fantastic as well, and if you want to know about the coming stages, that's as good a place as any to start. And well, Francois and I took a deep dive into the history and influence of L'Équipe, and coming early next week is my chat with their number one cycling writer, Alex Ruth. I spoke to him this morning at the Start Village. What a fantastic guy and a great writer, and we'll hear little clips of some of his poetic prose from L'Équipe from this Tour de France. And also on the rest day, the 11:01 cappuccino will be going out. So sign up for that at thecyclingpodcast.com. Sign up as a friend of the podcast also at thecyclingpodcast.com. And for the first time, you can sign up on a monthly basis. So if you just want to have a listen to all the tour episodes, you can do so. And it will cost you about the cost of a couple of cappuccinos. Not the 11:01 cappuccino, that's free. But actual real cappuccinos. Anyway, tomorrow we will be in, where will we be? We'll be in Saint-Gervais. That's right. So until then, thank you very much, Lizzie. Welcome to the tour.
Thank you. And thank you, Lionel.
And thank you, Ian.
Thank you, Lionel.
Let's go and have some cheese.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds, or Skims. Sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more, sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.